Chapter 6. When Shevik was sent home after a decad in hospital, his neighbor in room 45 came in to see him. He was a mathematician, very tall and thin. He had an uncorrected walleye, so that you never could be sure whether he was looking at you and or you were looking at him. He and Shevik had coexisted amicably, side by side in the institute domicile for a year, without ever saying a full sentence to each other. Dessar now came in and stared at, or beside, Shevik. "Anything?" he said.
"I'm doing fine, thanks.
What about bring dinner comments?" "With yours?" Shevik said, influenced by Dessar's telegraphic style. "All right." Dessar brought two dinners on a tray over from the Institute refectory, and they ate together in Shevik's room. He did the same morning and night for 3 days, till Shevik felt up to going out again. It was hard to see why Dessar did this. He was not friendly, and the expectations of brotherhood seemed to mean little to him. One reason he held aloof from people was to hide his dishonesty. He was either appallingly lazy or, frankly, proprietarian, for room 45 was full of stuff that he had no right or reason to keep. Dishes from commons, books from libraries, a set of woodcarving tools from a craft supply depot, a microscope from some laboratory, 8 different blankets, a closet stuffed with clothes, some of which plainly did not fit Dessar and never had, others of which appeared to be things he had worn when he was 8 or 10. It looked as if he went to depositories and warehouses and picked things up by the armload, whether he needed them or not. "What do you keep all this junk for?" Shevik asked when he was first admitted to the room. Dessar stared between him. "Just builds up," he said vaguely. Dessar's chosen field in mathematics was so esoteric that nobody in the Institute or the Math Federation could really check on his progress. That was precisely why he had chosen it. He assumed that Shevik's motivation was the same. "Hell," he said. "Work? Good post here. Sequency. Simultaneity. Shit." At some moments, Shevik liked Dessar, and at others detested him for the same qualities. He stuck to him, however, deliberately, as part of his resolution to change his life. His illness had made him realize that if he tried to go on alone, he would break down altogether. He saw this in moral terms and judged himself ruthlessly. He had been keeping himself for himself, against the ethical imperative of brotherhood. Shevik, at 21, was not a prig, exactly, because his morality was passionate and drastic, but it was still fitted to a rigid mold, the simplistic Odonianism taught to children by mediocre adults, and internalized preaching. He had been doing wrong. He must do right. He did so. He forbade himself physics 5 nights in 10. He volunteered for committee work in the Institute domicile management. He attended meetings of the Physics Federation and the syndicate of members of the Institute. He enrolled with a group who were practicing biofeedback exercises and brainwave training. At the refectory, he forced himself to sit down at the large tables instead of at a small one with a book in front of him. It was surprising. People seemed to have been waiting for him. They included him, welcomed him, invited him as bedfellow and companion. They took him about with them, and within 3 decades, he learned more about Abani than he had in a year. He went with groups of cheerful young people to athletic fields, craft centers, swimming pools, festivals, museums, theaters, concerts. The concerts. They were a revelation, a shock of joy. He had never gone to a concert here in Abani, partly because he thought of music as something you do rather than something you hear. As a child, he had always sung or played one instrument or another in local choirs and ensembles. He had enjoyed it very much, but had not had much talent. And that was all he knew of music. Learning centers taught all the skills that prepare for the practice of art, training in singing, metrics, dance, the use of brush, chisel, knife, lathe, and so on. It was all pragmatic. The children learned to see, speak, hear, move, handle. No distinction was drawn between the arts and the crafts. Art was not considered as having a place in life, but as being a basic technique of life, like speech. Thus, architecture had developed, early and freely, a consistent style, pure and plain, subtle in proportion. Painting and sculpture served largely as elements of architecture and town planning. As for the arts of words, poetry and storytelling tended to be ephemeral, to be linked with song and dancing. Only the theater stood wholly alone, and only the theater was ever called the art, a thing complete in itself. There were many regional and traveling troupes of actors and dancers, repertory companies, very often with playwright attached. They performed tragedies, semi-improvised comedies, mimes. They were as welcome as rain in the lonely desert towns. They were the glory of the year wherever they came. Rising out of and embodying the isolation and communality of the Anaresti spirit, the drama had attained extraordinary power and brilliance. Shevik, however, was not very sensitive to the drama. He liked the verbal splendor, but the whole idea of acting was uncongenial to him. It was not until this second year in Abani that he discovered at last his art, the art that is made out of time. Somebody took him along to a concert at the Syndicate of Music. He went back the next night. He went to every concert, with his new acquaintances if possible, without, if need be. The music was a more urgent need, a deeper satisfaction, than the companionship. His efforts to break out of his essential seclusion were, in fact, a failure, and he knew it. He made no close friend. He copulated with a number of girls, but copulation was not the joy it ought to be. It was a mere relief of need, like evacuating, and he felt ashamed of it afterward, because it involved another person as object. Masturbation was preferable, the suitable course for a man like himself. Solitude was his fate. He was trapped in his heredity. She had said it. The work comes first. Rulag had said it calmly, stating fact, powerless to change it, to break out of her cold cell. So it was with him. His heart yearned towards them, the kindly young souls who called him brother, but he could not reach them, nor they him. He was born to be alone, a damned cold intellectual, an egoist. The work came first, but it went nowhere. Like sex, it ought to have been a pleasure, and it wasn't. He kept grinding over the same problems, getting not a step nearer the solution of Toe's temporal paradox, let alone the theory of simultaneity, which last year he had thought was almost in his grasp. That self-assurance now seemed incredible to him. Had he really thought himself capable, at age 20, of evolving a theory that would change the foundations of cosmological physics? He had been out of his mind for a good while, before the fever, evidently. He enrolled in 2 work groups in philosophical mathematics, convincing himself that he needed them, and refusing to admit that he could have directed either course as well as the instructors. He avoided Sabul as much as he could. In his first burst of new resolutions, he had made a point of getting to know Gvarab better. She responded as well as she could, but the winter had been hard on her. She was ill, and deaf, and old. She started a spring course, and then gave it up. She was erratic, hardly recognizing Shevik one time, and the next, dragging him off to her domicile for a whole evening's talk. He had got somewhat beyond Gvarab's ideas, and he found these long talks hard. Either he had to let Gvarab bore him for hours, repeating what he already knew or had partly disproved, or he had to hurt and confuse her by trying to set her straight. It was beyond the patience or tact of anyone his age, and he ended up evading Guevara when he could, always with a bad conscience. There was nobody else to talk shop with. Nobody at the Institute knew enough about pure temporal physics to keep up with him. He would have liked to teach it, but he had not yet been given a teaching posting or a classroom at the Institute. The faculty student syndicate of members turned down his request for one. They did not want a quarrel with Sabul. As the year went on, he took to spending a good deal of his time writing letters to Atro and other physicists and mathematicians on Urus. Few of these letters were sent. Some he wrote and then simply tore up. He discovered that the mathematician, Loayan, to whom he had written a 6-page discourse on temporal reversibility, had been dead for 20 years. He had neglected to read the biographical preface to An's Geometrics of Time. Other letters, which he undertook to get carried by the freight ships from Urus, were stopped by the managers of the port of Abani. The port was under direct control of PDC, since its operation involved the coordination of many syndicates, and some of the coordinators had to know Iotic. These port managers, with their special knowledge and important position, tended to acquire the bureaucratic mentality. They said no automatically. They mistrusted the letters to mathematicians, which looked like code, and which nobody could assure them weren't code. Letters to physicists were passed as if Sabul, their consultant, approved them. He would not approve those that dealt with subjects outside his own brand of sequency physics.
"Not within my competence," he would growl, pushing the letter aside.
Shevek would send it on to the port managers anyhow, and it would come back marked, "Not approved for export." He brought this matter up with the Physics Federation, which Sabul seldom bothered to attend. Nobody there attached importance to the issue of free communication with the ideological enemy. Some of them lectured Shevek for working in a field so arcane that there was, by his own admission, nobody else on his own world competent in it. "But it's only new," he said, which got him nowhere.
"If it's new, share it with us, not with the proprietarians."
"I've tried to offer a course every quarter for a year now. You always say there isn't enough demand for it. Are you afraid of it because it's new?" That won him no friends. He left them in anger. He went on writing letters to Urus, even when he mailed none of them at all. The fact of writing for someone who might understand, who might have understood, made it possible for him to write, to think. Otherwise, it was not possible. The decades went by, and the quarters. 2 or 3 times a year, the reward came. A letter from Atro, or another physicist in Aio or Thu. A long letter, close written, close argued. All theory from salutation to signature. All intense, abstruse, metamathematical, ethico-cosmological temporal physics, written in a language he could not speak, by men he did not know, fiercely trying to combat and destroy his theories, enemies of his homeland, rivals, strangers, brothers. For days after getting a letter, he was irascible and joyful, worked day and night, foamed out ideas like a fountain, then slowly, with desperate spurts and struggles, he came back to Earth, to dry ground. Ran dry. He was finishing his 3rd year at the Institute when Gvarab died. He asked to speak at her memorial service, which was held, as the custom was, in the place where the dead person had worked. In this case, one of the lecture rooms in the physics laboratory building. He was the only speaker. No students attended. Gvarab had not taught for 2 years. A few elderly members of the Institute came, and Guvarob's middle-aged son, an agricultural chemist from Northeast, was there. Shevik stood where the old woman had used to stand to lecture. He told these people, in a voice hoarsened by his now customary winter chest cold, that Guvarob had laid the foundations of the science of time, and was the greatest cosmologist who had ever worked at the Institute. "We in physics have our Odo now," he said. "We have her, and we did not honor her." Afterwards, an old woman thanked him, with tears in her eyes. "We always took 10th days together, her and me, janitoring in our block. We used to have such good times talking," she said, wincing in the icy wind as they came out of the building. The agricultural chemist muttered civilities and hurried off to catch a ride back to Northeast. In a rage of grief, impatience, and futility, Shevik struck off, walking at random through the city. 3 years here, and he had accomplished what? A book appropriated by Sabu, 5 or 6 unpublished papers, and a funeral oration for a wasted life. Nothing he did was understood. To put it more honestly, nothing he did was meaningful. He was fulfilling no necessary function, personal or social. In fact, it was not an uncommon phenomenon in his field. He had burnt out at 20. He would achieve nothing further. He had come up against the wall for good. He stopped in front of the Music Syndicate Auditorium to read the programs for the Deckcat. There was no concert tonight. He turned away from the poster and came face to face with Badap. Badap, always defensive and rather nearsighted, gave no sign of recognition. Shevik caught his arm. "Shevik, by damn, it's you!" They hugged each other, kissed, broke apart, hugged again. Shevik was overwhelmed by love. Why? He had not even much liked Badap that last year at the Regional Institute. They had never written these 3 years. Their friendship was a boyhood one, past. Yet love was there, flamed up as from shaken coal. They walked, talked, neither noticing where they went. They waved their arms and interrupted each other. The wide streets of Abani were quiet in the winter night. At each crossing, the dim streetlight made a pool of silver, across which dry snow flurried like shoals of tiny fish chasing their shadows. The wind came bitter cold behind the snow. Numbed lips and chattering teeth began to interfere with conversation. They caught the 10 o'clock omnibus, the last, to the Institute. Badap's domicile was out on the east edge of the city, a long pull in the cold. He looked at room 46 with ironic wonder. "Shev, you live like a rotten Arasti profiteer." "Come on, it's not that bad. Show me anything excremental." The room, in fact, contained just about what it had when Shevik first entered it. Badap pointed. "That blanket. That was here when I came. Somebody handmade it and left it when they moved. Is a blanket excessive on a night like this?" "It's definitely an excremental color," Badap said. "As a functions analyst, I must point out that there is no need for orange. Orange serves no vital function in the social organism at either the cellular or the organic level, and certainly not at the whole organismic or most centrally ethical level, in which case tolerance is a less good choice than excretion. Diet dirty green, brother." "What's all this stuff?" "Notes." "In code?" Badap asked, looking through a notebook with the coolness Shevik remembered was characteristic of him. He had even less sense of privacy, of private ownership, than most Anaresti. Badap had never had a favorite pencil that he carried around with him, or an old shirt he had got fond of and hated to dump in the recycle bin. And if given a present, he tried to keep it out of regard for the giver's feelings, but always lost it. He was conscious of this trait and said it showed he was less primitive than most people. An early example of the promised man, the true and native Odonian. But he did have a sense of privacy. It began at the skull, his own or another's, and from there on it was complete. He never pried. He said now, "Remember those fool letters we used to write in code when you were on the afforestation project?" "That isn't code. It's Eotic."
"You've learned Eotic? Why do you write in it?"
"Because nobody on this planet can understand what I'm saying, or wants to. The only one who did died 3 days ago."
"Sabul's dead?"
"No, Gvarab. Sabul isn't dead. Fat chance. What's the trouble? The trouble with Sabul? Half envy, the other half incompetence. I thought his book on causality was supposed to be first rate. You said so. I thought so, till I read the sources. They're all Urasti ideas, not new ones, either. He hasn't had a thought of his own for 20 years, or a bath. How are your thoughts? Asked Badap, putting a hand on the notebooks and looking at Shevik under his brows. Badap had small, rather squinting eyes, a strong face, a thick-set body. He bit his fingernails, and in years of doing so had reduced them to mere strips across his thick, sensitive fingertips. No good, said Shevik, sitting down on the bed platform. I'm in the wrong field. Badap grinned. You? I think at the end of this quarter I'll ask for reposting. To what? I don't care. Teaching, engineering? I've got to get out of physics. Badap sat down in the desk chair, bit a fingernail, and said, That sounds odd. I've recognized my limitations. I didn't know you had any. In physics, I mean. You had all sorts of limitations and defects, but not in physics. I'm no temporalist, I know, but you don't have to be able to swim to know a fish. You don't have to shine to recognize a star. Shevik looked at his friend and said, blurted out, what he had never been able to say clearly to himself. I've thought of suicide, a good deal, this year. It seems the best way. It's hardly the way to come out on the other side of suffering. Shevik smiled, stiffly. You remember that? Vividly. It was a very important conversation to me. And to Takvar and Tiran, I think. Was it? Shevik stood up. There was only 4 steps, pacing room, but he could not hold still. It was important to me then, he said, standing at the window. But I've changed here. There's something wrong here. I don't know what it is. I do, Badap said. The wall. You've come up against the wall. Shevik turned with a frightened look. The wall? In your case, the wall seems to be Sabul and his supporters in the science syndicates and the PDC. As for me, I've been in Abenai 4 decades. 40 days. Long enough to see that in 40 years here, I'll accomplish nothing. Nothing at all of what I want to do. The improvement of science instruction in the learning centers. Unless things are changed. Or, unless I join the enemies. Enemies? The little men. Sabul's friends, the people in power. What are you talking about, Dap? We have no power structure. No? What makes Sabul so strong? Not a power structure, a government. This isn't Urus, after all. No? We have no government, no laws. All right. But as far as I can see, ideas never were controlled by laws and governments, even on Urus. If they had been, how would Odo have worked out hers? How would Adonianism have become a world movement? The Archists tried to stamp it out by force and failed. You can't crush ideas by suppressing them. You can only crush them by ignoring them, by refusing to think, refusing to change. And that's precisely what our society is doing. Sabul uses you where he can, and where he can't, he prevents you from publishing, from teaching, even from working. Right? In other words, he has power over you. Where does he get it from? Not from vested authority, there isn't any. Not from intellectual excellence, he hasn't any. He gets it from the innate cowardice of the average human mind, public opinion. That's the power structure he's part of and knows how to use. The unadmitted, inadmissible government that rules the Odonian society by stifling the individual mind. Shevik leaned his hands on the windowsill, looking through the dim reflections on the pane into the darkness outside. He said at last, Crazy talk, Dap. No, brother, I'm sane. What drives people crazy is trying to live outside reality. Reality is terrible. It can kill you. Given time, it certainly will kill you. The reality is pain. You said that. But it's the lies, the evasions of reality that drive you crazy. It's the lies that make you want to kill yourself. Shevik turned around to face him. But you can't seriously talk of a government here. Tomar's definitions, government, the legal use of power to maintain and extend power. Replace legal with customary, and you've got Sabul and the Syndicate of Instruction and the PDC.
The PDC?
The PDC is, by now, basically anarchistic bureaucracy. After a moment, Shivik laughed, not quite naturally, and said, "Well, come on, Dap, this is amusing, but it's a bit diseased, isn't it?" "Shiv, did you ever think that what the analogic mode calls disease, social disaffection, discontent, alienation, that this might analogically also be called pain? What you meant when you talked about pain, suffering? And that, like pain, it serves a function in the organism?"
"No,"
Shevik said violently. "I was talking in personal, in spiritual terms." "But you spoke of physical suffering, of a man dying of burns, and I speak of spiritual suffering, of people seeing their talent, their work, their lives wasted, of good minds submitting to stupid ones, of strength and courage strangled by envy, greed for power, fear of change. Change is freedom. Change is life. Is anything more basic to Odonian thought than that? But nothing changes anymore. Our society is sick. You know it. You're suffering its sickness. It's suicidal sickness. That's enough, Dap. Drop it." But Dap said no more. He began to bite his thumbnail, methodically and thoughtfully. Shivik sat down again on the bed platform and put his head in his hands. There was a long silence. The snow had ceased. A dry, dark wind pushed at the window pane. The room was cold. Neither of the young men had taken off his coat. "Look, brother," Shevik said at last. "It's not our society that frustrates individual creativity. It's the poverty of Anaris. This planet wasn't meant to support civilization. If we let one another down, if we don't give up our personal desires to the common good, nothing, nothing on this barren world can save us. Human solidarity is our only resource." "Solidarity, yes. Even on Urus, where food falls out of the trees, even there, Odo said that human solidarity is our one hope. But we betrayed that hope. We've let cooperation become obedience. On Urus, they have government by the minority. Here, we have government by the majority. But it is government. The social conscience isn't a living thing anymore, but a machine, a power machine, controlled by bureaucrats. You or I could volunteer and be lottery posted to PDC within a few decades. Would that turn us into bureaucrats? Bosses? It's not the individuals posted to PDC, Shev. Most of them are like us, all too much like us. Well-meaning, naive. And it's not just PDC, it's anywhere on Anaris. Learning centers, institutes, mines, mills, fisheries, canneries, agricultural development and research stations, factories, one-product communities, anywhere that function demands expertise in a stable institution. But that stability gives scope to the authoritarian impulse. In the early years of the settlement, we were aware of that, on the lookout for it. People discriminated very carefully then between administering things and governing people. They did it so well that we forgot that the will to dominance is as central in human beings as the impulse to mutual aid is, and has to be trained in each individual, in each new generation. Nobody's born an Odonian any more than he's born civilized, but we've forgotten that. We don't educate for freedom. Education, the most important activity of the social organism, has become rigid, moralistic, authoritarian. Kids learn to parrot Odo's words as if they were laws, the ultimate blasphemy. Shevik hesitated. He had experienced too much of the kind of teaching Badap was talking about as a child, and even here at the Institute, to be able to deny Badap's accusation. Badap seized his advantage relentlessly. "It's always easier not to think for oneself. Find a nice, safe hierarchy and settle in. Don't make changes. Don't risk disapproval. Don't upset your syndics. It's always easiest to let yourself be governed." "But it's not government, Dap.
The experts and the old hands are going to manage any crew or syndicate. They know the work best. The work has to get done, after all. As for PDC, yes, it might become a hierarchy, a power structure, if it weren't organized to prevent exactly that. Look how it's set up. Volunteers selected by lot, a year of training, then 4 years as a listing, then out. Nobody could gain power, in the archist's sense, in a system like that, with only 4 years to do it in. Some stay on longer than 4 years. Advisors? They don't keep the vote. Votes aren't important. There are people behind the scenes. Come on! That's sheer paranoia. Behind the scenes. How? What scenes? Anybody can attend any PDC meeting, and if he's an interested syndic, he can debate and vote. Are you trying to pretend that we have politicians here? Shevek was furious with Bedap. His prominent ears were scarlet. His voice had got loud. It was late, not a light showing across the quadrangle. Dessar in room 45 knocked on the wall for quiet. I'm saying what you know, Bedap replied in a much lower voice. That it's people like Sabu who really run PDC and run it year after year. If you know that, Shevek accused in a harsh whisper, then why haven't you made it public? Why haven't you called a criticism session in your syndicate if you have facts? If your ideas won't stand public examination, I don't want them as midnight whispers. Bedap's eyes had got very small, like steel beads. Brother, he said, you are self-righteous. You always were. Look outside your own damned pure conscience for once. I come to you and whisper because I know I can trust you. Damn you! Who else can I talk to? Do I want to end up like Tyrion? Like Tyrion? Shevek was startled into raising his voice. Bedap hushed him with a gesture towards the wall. What's wrong with Tyrion? Where is he? In the asylum on Segvina Island. In the asylum? Bedap hunched his knees up to his chin and wrapped his arms around them as he sat sideways on the chair. He spoke quietly now, with reluctance. Tyrion wrote a play and put it on the year after you left. It was funny, crazy. You know his kind of thing. Bedap ran a hand through his rough, sandy hair, loosening it from its cue. It could seem anti-Odonian if you were stupid. A lot of people are stupid. There was a fuss. He got reprimanded, public reprimand. I never saw one before. Everybody comes to your syndicate meeting and tells you off. It used to be how they cut a bossy gang foreman or manager down to size. Now they only use it to tell an individual to stop thinking for himself. It was bad. Tyrion couldn't take it. I think it really drove him a bit out of his mind. He felt everybody was against him after that. He started talking too much, bitter talk, not irrational, but always critical, always bitter. And he talked to anybody that way. Well, he finished at the Institute, qualified as a math instructor, and asked for a posting. He got one. To a road repair crew in South Setting. He protested it was an error, but the DivLab computers repeated it. So he went. Tyr never worked outdoors the whole time I knew him, Shevek interrupted. Since he was 10, he always wangled desk jobs. DivLab was being fair. Bedap paid no attention. I don't really know what happened down there. He wrote to me several times, and each time he'd been reposted, always to physical labor in little outpost communities. He wrote that he was quitting his post and coming back to North Setting to see me. He didn't come. He stopped writing. I traced him through the Abenai labor files, finally. They sent me a copy of his card, and the last entry was just Therapy, Segvina Island. Therapy? Did Tyrion murder somebody? Did he rape somebody? What do you get sent to the asylum for beside that? You don't get sent to the asylum at all. You request posting to it. Don't feed me that crap, Bedap said with sudden rage. He never asked to be sent there. They drove him crazy and then sent him there. It's Tyrion I'm talking about. Tyrion, do you remember him? I knew him before you did. What do you think the asylum is? A prison? It's a refuge. If there are murderers and chronic work quitters there, it's because they asked to go there, where they're not under pressure and safe from retribution. But who are these crazy people you keep talking about? They drove him crazy, and so on. Are you trying to say that the whole social system is evil? That in fact they, tyrants, persecutors, your enemies, they are us? The social organism?
If you can dismiss Tyrann from your conscience as a work quitter, I don't think I have anything else to say to you, Badap replied, sitting hunched up on the chair. There was such plain and simple grief in his voice that Shevik's righteous wrath was stopped short. Neither spoke for a while. I'd better go home, Badap said, unfolding stiffly and standing up. It's an hour's walk from here. Don't be stupid. Well, I thought, since... Don't be stupid. All right. Where's the shittery? Left, third door. When he came back, Badap proposed to sleep on the floor, but as there was no rug and only one warm blanket, this idea was, as Shevik monotonously remarked, stupid. They were both glum and cross, sore, as if they had fist-fought but not fought all their anger out. Shevik unrolled the bedding and they lay down. At the turning out of the lamp, a silvery darkness came into the room, the half-darkness of a city night where there is snow on the ground and light reflects faintly upward from the earth. It was cold. Each felt the warmth of the other's body is very welcome. I take it back about the blanket. Listen, Dap, I didn't mean to... Oh, let's talk about it in the morning. Right. They moved closer together. Shevik turned over onto his face and fell asleep within 2 minutes. Badap struggled to hold on to consciousness, slipped into the warmth, deeper, into the defenselessness, the trustfulness of sleep, and slept. In the night, one of them cried out aloud, dreaming. The other one reached his arm out sleepily, muttering reassurance, and the blind, warm weight of his touch outweighed all fear. They met again the next evening and discussed whether or not they should pair for a while, as they had when they were adolescent. It had to be discussed because Shevik was pretty definitely heterosexual, and Badap pretty definitely homosexual. The pleasure of it would be mostly for Badap. Shevik was perfectly willing, however, to reconfirm the old friendship, and when he saw that the sexual element of it meant a great deal to Badap, was, to him, a true consummation, then he took the lead, and with considerable tenderness and obstinacy, made sure that Badap spent the night with him again. They took a free single in a domicile downtown, and both lived there for about a decade. Then they separated again, Badap to his dormitory, and Shevik to room 46. There was no strong sexual desire on either side to make the connection last. They had simply reasserted trust. Yet Shevik sometimes wondered, as he went on seeing Badap almost daily, what it was he liked and trusted in his friend. He found Badap's present opinions detestable, and his insistence on talking about them tiresome. They argued fiercely almost every time they met. They caused each other a good deal of pain. Leaving Badap, Shevik frequently accused himself of merely clinging to an outgrown loyalty, and swore angrily not to see Badap again. But the fact was that he liked Badap more as a man than he ever had as a boy. Inept, insistent, dogmatic, destructive, Badap could be all that, but he had attained a freedom of mind that Shevik craved, though he hated its expression. He had changed Shevik's life, and Shevik knew it, knew that he was going on at last, and that it was Badap who had enabled him to go on. He fought Badap every step of the way, but he kept coming, to argue, to do hurt and get hurt, to find, under anger, denial, and rejection, what he sought. He did not know what he sought, but he knew where to look for it. It was, consciously, as unhappy a time for him as the year that had preceded it. He was still getting no further with his work. In fact, he had abandoned temporal physics altogether and backtracked into humble lab work, setting up various experiments in the radiation laboratory with a deft, silent technician his partner, studying subatomic velocities. It was a well-trodden field, and his belated entry into it was taken by his colleagues as an admission that he had finally stopped trying to be original. The syndicate of members of the Institute gave him a course to teach, mathematical physics for entering students. He got no sense of triumph from finally having been given a course, for it was just that. He had been given it, been permitted it. He got little comfort from anything. That the walls of his hard puritanical conscience were widening out immensely was anything but a comfort. He felt cold and lost, but he had nowhere to retreat to, no shelter. So he kept coming farther out into the cold, getting farther lost. Bedapp had made many friends, an erratic and disaffected lot, and some of them took a liking to the shy man. He felt no closer to them than to the more conventional people he knew at the Institute, but he found their independence of mind more interesting. They preserved autonomy of conscience even at the cost of becoming eccentric. Some of them were intellectual nutschnibbi, who had not worked on a regular posting for years. Shevik disapproved of them severely when he was not with them. One of them was a composer named Salas. Salas and Shevik wanted to learn from each other. Salas had little math, but as long as Shevik could explain physics in the analogic or experimental modes, he was an eager and intelligent listener. In the same way, Shevik would listen to anything Salas could tell him about musical theory, and anything Salas would play him on tape or on his instrument, the portative. But some of what Salas told him, he found extremely troubling. Salas had taken a posting to a canal-digging crew on the plains of the Tamaya, east of Avani. He came into the city on his 3 days off each decad, and stayed with one girl or another. Shevik assumed that he had taken the posting because he wanted a bit of outdoor work for a change. But then he found that Salas had never taken a posting in music, or in anything but unskilled labor. "What's your listing at DivLab?" he asked, puzzled. "General labor pool." "But you're skilled. You put in 6 or 8 years of the Music Syndicate Conservatory, didn't you? Why don't they post you to music teaching?" "They did. I refused. I won't be ready to teach for another 10 years. I'm a composer, remember, not a performer." "But there must be postings for composers." "Where?" "In the Music Syndicate, I suppose. But the music syndics don't like my compositions. And nobody much else does, yet. I can't be a syndicate all by myself, can I?" Salas was a bony little man, already bald on the upper face and cranium. He wore what was left of his hair short, in a silky beige fringe around the back of his neck and chin. His smile was sweet, wrinkling his expressive face. "You see, I don't write the way I was trained to write at the conservatory. I write dysfunctional music." He smiled more sweetly than ever. "They want chorales. I hate chorales. They want wide harmony pieces like Saussure wrote. I hate Saussure's music. I'm writing a piece of chamber music, thought I might call it the simultaneity principle. 5 instruments, each playing an independent cyclic theme. No melodic causality. The forward process entirely in the relationship of the parts. It makes a lovely harmony. But they don't hear it. They won't hear it. They can't." Shevik brooded a while. "If you called it the joys of solidarity," he said, "would they hear it?" "By damn," said Bedapp, who was listening in. "That's the first cynical thing you ever said in your life, Shev. Welcome to the work crew." Salas laughed. "They'd give it a hearing, but they'd turn it down for taping a regional performance. It's not in the organic style." "No wonder I never heard any professional music while I lived in North City." "But how can they justify this kind of censorship? You write music. Music is a cooperative art. Organic by definition, social. It may be the noblest form of social behavior we're capable of.
It's certainly one of the noblest jobs an individual can undertake. And by its nature, by the nature of any art, it's a sharing. The artist shares. It's the essence of his act. No matter what your syndics say, how can DivLab justify not giving you a posting in your own field? They don't want to share it, Salah said gleefully. It scares them. Badab spoke more gravely. They can justify it because music isn't useful. Canal digging is important, you know. Music's mere decoration. The circle has come right back around to the most vile kind of profiteering utilitarianism. The complexity, the vitality, the freedom of invention and initiative that was the center of the Odonian ideal. We've thrown it all away. We've gone right back to barbarism. If it's new, run away from it. If you can't eat it, throw it away. Shevik thought of his own work and had nothing to say. Yet he could not join in Badap's criticism. Badap had forced him to realize that he was, in fact, a revolutionary, but he felt profoundly that he was such by virtue of his upbringing and education as an Odonian and an Honoresti. He could not rebel against his society because his society, properly conceived, was a revolution, a permanent one, an ongoing process. To reassert its validity and strength, he thought, one need only act, without fear of punishment and without hope of reward, act from the center of one's soul. Badap and some of his friends were taking off a Deccad together, going on a hiking tour in the Nathera. He had persuaded Shevik to come. Shevik liked the prospect of 10 days in the mountains, but not the prospect of 10 days of Badap's opinions. Badap's conversation was all too much like a criticism session, the communal activity he had always liked least, when everybody stood up and complained about defects in the functioning of the community, and, usually, defects in the characters of the neighbors. The nearer the vacation came, the less he looked forward to it. But he stuck a notebook in his pocket so he could get away and pretend to be working, and went. They met behind the Eastern Points trucking depot early in the morning, three women and three men. Shevik did not know any of the women, and Badap introduced him to only two of them. As they set off on the road toward the mountains, he fell in beside the third one. Shevik, he said. She said, I know. He realized that he must have met her somewhere before and should know her name. His ears got red. Are you being funny? Badap asked, moving in on the left. Takver was at North Setting Institute with us. She's been living in Abani for 2 years. Haven't you two seen each other here till now? I've seen him a couple of times, the girl said, and laughed at him. She had the laugh of a person who likes to eat well, a big, childish gape. She was tall and rather thin, with round arms and broad hips. She was not very pretty. Her face was swarthy, intelligent, and cheerful. In her eyes, there was a darkness, not the opacity of bright, dark eyes, but a quality of depth, almost like deep, black, fine ash, very soft. Shevik, meeting her eyes, knew that he had committed an unforgivable fault in forgetting her, and, in the instant of knowing it, knew also that he had been forgiven, that he was in luck, that his luck had changed. They started up into the mountains. In the cold evening of the fourth day of their excursion, he and Takver sat on the bare, steep slope above a gorge. 40 meters below them, a mountain torrent rattled down the ravine among spray-wet rocks. There was little running water on Anaris. The water table was low in most places. Rivers were short. Only in the mountains were there quick-running streams. The sound of water shouting and clattering and singing was new to them. They had been scrambling up and down such gorges all day in the high country and were leg-weary. The rest of their party were in the way shelter, a stone lodge built by and for vacationers and well kept up. The Nathera Federative was the most active of the volunteer groups that managed and protected the rather limited scenic areas of Anaris. A fire warden who lived there in summer
was helping Bedap and the others put together a dinner from the well-stocked pantries. Tokver and Shevik had gone out, in that order, separately, without announcing their destination, or, in fact, knowing it. He found her on the steep slope, sitting among the delicate bushes of moonthorn that grew like knots of lace over the mountainsides, its stiff, fragile branches silvery in the twilight. In a gap between eastern peaks, a colorless luminosity of the sky heralded moonrise. The stream was noisy in the silence of the high, bare hills. There was no wind, no cloud. The air above the mountains was like amethyst, hard, clear, profound. They had been sitting there some while without speaking. "I've never been drawn to a woman in my life as I have been to you, ever since we started this hike." Chivik's tone was cold, almost resentful. "I didn't mean to spoil your vacation," she said, with her large childish laugh, too loud for the twilight. "It doesn't spoil it." "That's good. I thought you meant it distracted you." "Distracted? It's like an earthquake." "Thank you." "It's not you," he said harshly. "It's me." "That's what you think," she said. There was a longish pause. "If you want to copulate," she said, "why haven't you asked me?"
"Because I'm not sure that's what I do want."
"Neither am I." Her smile was gone. "Listen," she said. Her voice was soft and had not much timbre. It had the same furry quality as her eyes. "I ought to tell you." But what she ought to tell him remained unsaid for quite a while. He looked at her at last with such pleading apprehension that she hastened to speak and said in a rush, "Well, all I mean is I don't want to copulate with you now. Or anybody."
"You've sworn off sex?"
"No," she said with indignation, but no explanation.
"I might as well have," he said, flinging a pebble down into the stream. "Or else I'm impotent. It's been half a year, and that was just with Dap. Nearly a year, actually. It kept getting more unsatisfying each time till I quit trying. It wasn't worth it. Not worth the trouble. And yet I remember, I know what it ought to be."
"Well, that's it," said Tokver. "I used to have an awful lot of fun copulating until I was 18 or 19. It was exciting and interesting and pleasure. But then, I don't know, like you said, it got unsatisfying. I didn't want pleasure, not just pleasure, I mean."
"You want kids?"
"Yes, when the time comes."
He pitched another rock down into the stream, which was fading into the shadows of the ravine, leaving only its noise behind, a ceaseless harmony composed of disharmonies.
"I want to get a job done," he said. "Does being celibate help?"
"There's a connection, but I don't know what it is. It's not causal. About the time sex began to go sour on me, so did the work, increasingly. 3 years without getting anywhere. Sterility on all sides. As far as the eye can see, the infertile desert lies in the pitiless glare of the merciless sun, a lifeless, trackless, feckless, fuckless waste, strewn with the bones of luckless wayfarers." Tokver did not laugh. She gave a whimper of laughter, as though it hurt. He tried to make out her face clearly. Behind her dark head, the sky was hard and clear. "What's wrong with pleasure, Tokver? Why don't you want it?"
"Nothing's wrong with it, and I do want it. Only I don't need it. And if I take what I don't need, I'll never get to do what I do need."
"What is it you need?"
She looked down at the ground, scratching the surface of a rock outcrop with her fingernail. She said nothing. She leaned forward to pick a sprig of moonthorn, but did not take it, merely touched it, felt the furred stem and fragile leaf. Shevik saw in the tension of her movements that she was trying with all her strength to contain or restrain a storm of emotion, so that she could speak. When she did, it was in a low voice and a little roughly.
"I need the bond," she said. "The real one, body and mind and all the years of life. Nothing else. Nothing less."
She glanced up at him with defiance. It might have been hatred. Joy was rising mysteriously in him, like the sound and smell of the running water rising through the darkness. He had a feeling of unlimitedness, of clarity, total clarity, as if he had been set free. Behind Talkvair's head, the sky was brightening with moonrise. The far peaks floated clear and silver. "Yes, that's it," he said without self-consciousness, without any sense of talking to someone else. He said what came into his head, meditatively. "I never saw it." There was a little resentment still in Talkvair's voice.
"You never had to see it."
"Why not?"
"I suppose because you never saw the possibility of it."
"What do you mean, the possibility?"
"The person."
He considered this. They sat about a meter apart, hugging their knees because it was getting cold. Breath came to the throat like ice water. They could see each other's breath, faint vapor in the steadily growing moonlight.
"The night I saw it," Talkvair said, "was the night before you left North Setting Institute. There was a party, you remember. Some of us sat and talked all night, but that was 4 years ago, and you didn't even know my name."
The rancor was gone from her voice. She seemed to want to excuse him. "You saw in me then what I've seen in you this last 4 days?"
"I don't know. I can't tell. It wasn't just sexual. I'd noticed you before that way. This was different.
I saw you, but I don't know what you see now.
And I didn't really know what I saw then. I didn't know you well at all. Only when you spoke, I seemed to see clear into you and to the center. But you might have been quite different from what I thought you were."
"That wouldn't be your fault, after all," she added.
"It's just that I knew what I saw in you was what I needed, not just wanted."
"And you've been in Abenai for 2 years and didn't..."
"Didn't what?" "It was all on my side, in my head. You didn't even know my name.
One person can't make a bond after all." "And you were afraid that if you came to me, I might not want the bond?"
"Not afraid. I knew you were a person who wouldn't be forced. Well, yes, I was afraid. I was afraid of you. Not of making a mistake. I knew it wasn't a mistake, but you were yourself. You aren't like most people, you know. I was afraid of you because I knew you were my equal."
Her tone, as she ended, was fierce, but in a moment she said very gently, with kindness,
"It doesn't really matter, you know, Shevik."
It was the first time he had heard her say his name. He turned to her and said, stammering, almost choking,
"Doesn't matter?
First you show me what matters, what really matters, what I've needed all my life, and then you say it doesn't matter?" They were face to face now, but they had not touched.
"Is it what you need, then?"
"Yes. The bond, the chance."
"Now, for life?"
"Now and for life."
"Life," said the stream of quick water down on the rocks in the cold dark.
When Shevik and Talkvair came down from the mountains, they moved into a double room. None was free in the blocks near the Institute, but Talkvair knew of one not far away, in an old domicile in the north end of town. In order to get the room, they went to the block housing manager. Abenai was divided into about 200 local administrative regions, called blocks. A lens grinder who worked at home and kept her 3 young children at home with her. She therefore kept the housing files in a shelf on top of a closet, so the children wouldn't get at them. She checked that the room was registered as vacant. Shevik and Talkvair registered it as occupied by signing their names. The move was not complicated either. Shevik brought a box of papers, his winter boots, and the orange blanket. Talkvair had to make 3 trips. One was to the district clothing depository to get them both a new suit, an act which she felt obscurely but strongly was essential to beginning their partnership. Then she went to her old dormitory, once for her clothes and papers, and again with Shevik to bring a number of curious objects. Complex concentric shapes made of wire, which moved and changed slowly and inwardly when suspended from the ceiling. She had made these with scrap wire and tools from the craft supply depot, and called them occupations of uninhabited space. One of the room's two chairs was decrepit, so they took it by a repair shop, where they picked up a sound one. They were then furnished. The new room had a high ceiling, which made it airy and gave plenty of space for the occupations. The domicile was built on one of Abani's low hills, and the room had a corner window that caught the afternoon sunlight and gave a view of the city, the streets and squares, the roofs, the greener parks, the plains beyond. Intimacy after long solitude, the abruptness of joy, tried both Shevik's stability and Takfair's. In the first few decades, he had wild swings of elation and anxiety. She had fits of temper. Both were oversensitive and inexperienced. The strain did not last, as they became experts in each other. Their sexual hunger persisted as passionate delight. Their desire for communion was daily renewed because it was daily fulfilled. It was now clear to Shevik, and he would have thought it folly to think otherwise, that his wretched years in this city had all been part of his present great happiness, because they had led up to it, prepared him for it. Everything that had happened to him was part of what was happening to him now. Takfir saw no such obscure concatenations of effect, cause, effect. But then, she was not a temporal physicist. She saw time naively, as a road laid out. You walked ahead, and you got somewhere. If you were lucky, you got somewhere worth getting to. But when Shevik took her metaphor and recast it in his terms, explaining that unless the past and the future were made part of the present by memory and intention, there was, in human terms, no road, nowhere to go. She nodded before he was half done. Exactly, she said. That's what I was doing these last 4 years. It isn't all luck. Just partly. She was 23, a half year younger than Shevik. She had grown up in a farming community, Round Valley, in Northeast. It was an isolated place, and before Takfir had come to the Institute in North Setting, she had worked harder than most young Anaresti. There had been scarcely enough people in Round Valley to do the jobs that had to be done. But they were not a large enough community or productive enough in the general economy to get high priority from the DivLab computers. They had to look after themselves. Takfir, at 8, had picked straw and rocks out of holom grain at the mill for 3 hours a day after 3 hours of school. Little of her practical training as a child had been towards personal enrichment. It had been part of the community's effort to survive. At harvest and planting seasons, everyone over 10 and under 60 had worked in the fields all day. At 15, she had been in charge of coordinating the work schedules on the 400 farm plots worked by the community of Round Valley, and had assisted the planning dietitian in the town refectory. There was nothing unusual in all this, and Takfir thought little of it, but it had, of course, formed certain elements in her character and opinions. Shevik was glad he had done his share of Klegich, for Takfir was contemptuous of people who evaded physical labor. Look at Tanan, she would say, whining and howling because he got a draft posting for 4 decades to a root holom harvest. He's so delicate you'd think he was a fish egg. Has he ever touched dirt? Takfir was not particularly charitable, and she had a hot temper. She had studied biology at North Setting Regional Institute with sufficient distinction that she had decided to come to the Central Institute for further study. After a year, she had been asked to join in a new syndicate that was setting up a laboratory to study techniques of increasing and improving the edible fish stocks in the three oceans of Anaris. When people asked her what she did, she said, "I'm a fish geneticist." She liked the work. It combined two things she valued: accurate, factual research, and a specific goal of increase or betterment. Without such work, she would not have been satisfied. But it by no means sufficed her. Most of what went on in Tocvair's mind and spirit had little to do with fish genetics. Her concern with landscapes and living creatures was passionate. This concern, feebly called love of nature, seemed to Shevik to be something much broader than love. There are souls, he thought, whose umbilicus has never been cut. They never got weaned from the universe. They do not understand death as an enemy. They look forward to rotting and turning into humus. It was strange to see Tocvair take a leaf into her hand, or even a rock. She became an extension of it, it of her. She showed Shevik the seawater tanks at the research laboratory, 50 or more species of fish, large and small, drab and gaudy, elegant and grotesque. He was fascinated and a little awed. The three oceans of Anaris were as full of animal life as the land was empty of it. The seas had not been connected for several million years, so their life forms had followed insular courses of evolution. Their variety was bewildering. It had never occurred to Shevik that life could proliferate so wildly, so exuberantly, that indeed exuberance was perhaps the essential quality of life. On land, the plants got on well enough, in their sparse and spiny fashion. But those animals that had tried air breathing had mostly given up the project as the planet's climate entered a millennial era of dust and dryness. Bacteria survived, many of them lithophagous, and a few hundred species of worm and crustacean. Man fitted himself with care and risk into this narrow ecology. If he fished, but not too greedily, and if he cultivated, using mainly organic wastes for fertilizer, he could fit in. But he could not fit anybody else in. There was no grass for herbivores. There were no herbivores for carnivores. There were no insects to fecundate flowering plants. The imported fruit trees were all hand-fertilized. No animals were introduced from Urus to imperil the delicate balance of life. Only the settlers came, and so well scrubbed internally and externally that they brought a minimum of their personal fauna and flora with them. Not even the flea had made it to Anaris. "I like marine biology," Tocvair said to Shevik in front of the fish tanks, "because it's so complex, a real web. This fish eats that fish, eats small fry, eats ciliates, eat bacteria, and round you go. On land, there's only three phyla, all non-chordates, if you don't count man. It's a queer situation, biologically speaking. We Anaresti are unnaturally isolated. On the old world, there are 18 phyla of land animal. There are classes, like the insects, that have so many species they've never been able to count them. And some of those species have populations of billions. Think of it. Everywhere you looked, animals, other creatures, sharing the earth and air with you. You'd feel so much more apart." Her gaze followed the curve of a small blue fish's flight through the dim tank. Shevik, intent, followed the fish's track and her thoughts' track. He wandered among the tanks for a long time, and often came back with her to the laboratory and the aquaria, submitting his physicist's arrogance to those small strange lives, to the existence of beings to whom the present is eternal, beings that do not explain themselves and need not ever justify their ways to man. Most Anaresti worked 5 to 7 hours a day, with 2 to 4 days off each decad. Details of regularity, punctuality, which days off, and so on, were worked out between the individual and his work crew or gang or syndicate or coordinating federative on whichever level cooperation and efficiency could best be achieved. Tocvair ran her own research projects, but the work and the fish had their own imperative demands. She spent from 2 to 10 hours a day at the laboratory, no days off. Shevik had 2 teaching posts now, an advanced math course in a learning center, and another at the institute. Both courses were in the morning, and he got back to the room by noon. Usually Tokver was not back yet. The building was quite silent. The sunlight had not yet worked round to the double window that looked south and west over the city and the plains. The room was cool and shadowed. The delicate concentric mobiles hanging at different levels overhead moved with the introverted precision, silence, mystery of the organs of the body, or the processes of the reasoning mind. Shevek would sit down at the table under the windows and begin to work, reading or making notes or calculating. Gradually, the sunlight entered, shifted across the papers on the table, across his hands on the papers, and filled the room with radiance. And he worked. The false starts and futilities of the past years proved themselves to be groundwork, foundations, laid in the dark, but well laid. On these, methodically and carefully, but with a deftness and certainty that seemed nothing of his own, but a knowledge working through him, using him as its vehicle, he built up the beautiful, steadfast structure of the principles of simultaneity. Tokver, like any man or woman who undertakes companionship of the Creator's spirit, did not always have an easy time of it. Although her existence was necessary to Shevik, her actual presence could be a distraction. She didn't like to get home too early, because he often quit working when she got home, and she felt this to be wrong. Later on, when they were middle-aged and stodgy, he could ignore her, but at 24, he couldn't. Therefore, she arranged her tasks in the laboratory so that she did not get home till mid-afternoon. This was not a perfect arrangement either, for he needed looking after. On days when he had no classes, when she came in, he might have been sitting at the table for 6 or 8 hours straight. When he got up, he would lurch with fatigue, his hands would shake, and he was scarcely coherent. The usage the Creator Spirit gives its vessels is rough. It wears them out, discards them, gets a new model. For Tokver, there were no replacements. And when she saw how hard Shevik was used, she protested. She would have cried out, as Odo's husband Asieo did once, "For God's sake, girl, can't you serve truth a little at a time?" Except that she was the girl, and was unacquainted with God. They would talk, go out for a walk or to the baths, then to dinner at the Institute Commons. After dinner, there were meetings or a concert, where they saw their friends Badap and Selas in their circle, Desar and others from the Institute, Tokver's colleagues and friends. But the meetings and the friends were peripheral to them. Neither social nor sociable participation was necessary to them. Their partnership was enough, and they could not hide the fact. It did not seem to offend the others. Rather, the reverse. Badap, Selas, Desar, and the rest came to them as thirsty people come to a fountain. The others were peripheral to them, but they were central to the others. They did nothing much. They were not more benevolent than other people, or more brilliant talkers, and yet their friends loved them, depended on them, and kept bringing them presents. The small offerings that circulated among these people who possessed nothing and everything. A hand-knit scarf, a bit of granite studded with crimson garnets, a vase hand-thrown at the Potter's Federation workshop, a poem about love, a set of carved wooden buttons, a spiral shell from the Saruba Sea. They gave the present to Tokver, saying, "Here, Shev might like this for a paperweight." Or to Shevik, saying, "Here, Tok might like this color." In giving, they sought to share in what Shevik and Tokver shared, and to celebrate, and to praise. It was a long summer, warm and bright, the summer of the 160th year of the settlement of Anaris. Plentiful rains in the spring had greened the plains of Abani and laid the dust so that the air was unusually clear. The sun was warm by day, and at night The stars shone thick. When the moon was in the sky, one could make out the coastlines of its continents clearly, under the dazzling white whorls of its clouds.
"Why does it look so beautiful?"
Takver said, lying beside Shevik, under the orange blanket, the light out. Over them, the occupations of uninhabited space hung dim. Out the window, the full moon hung brilliant.
"When we know that it's a planet just like this one, only with a better climate and worse people, when we know they're all propertarians and fight wars and make laws and eat while others starve, and anyhow, are all getting older and having bad luck and getting rheumatic knees and corns on their toes just like people here, when we know all that, why does it still look so happy? As if life there must be so happy? I can't look at the radiance and imagine a horrid little man with greasy sleeves and an atrophied mind like Sabul living on it. I just can't."
Their naked arms and breasts were moonlight. The fine, faint down on Takver's face made a blurring aureole over her features. Her hair and the shadows were black. Shevik touched her silver arm with his silver hand, marveling at the warmth of the touch and that cool light.
"If you can see a thing whole," he said,
"it seems that it's always beautiful, planets, lives. But close up, a world's all dirt and rocks. And day to day, life's a hard job. You get tired, you lose the pattern. You need distance, interval. The way to see how beautiful the earth is to see it as the moon. The way to see how beautiful life is from the vantage point of death."
"That's all right for Urus. Let it stay off there and be the moon. I don't want it. But I'm not going to stand up on a gravestone and look down on life and say, 'Oh, lovely.' I want to see it whole, right in the middle of it, here, now. I don't give a hoot for eternity."
"It's nothing to do with eternity," said Shevik, grinning, a thin, shaggy man of silver and shadow. "All you have to do to see life whole is to see it as mortal. I'll die, you'll die. How could we love each other otherwise? The sun's going to burn out. What else keeps it shining?"
"Ah, your talk, your damned philosophy."
"Talk? It's not talk. It's not reason. It's hands touch. I touch the wholeness. I hold it. Which is moonlight, which is Takver. How shall I fear death? When I hold it in my hands, the light—"
"Don't be propertarian,"
Takver muttered.
"Dear heart, don't cry."
"I'm not crying."
"You are. Those are your tears."
"I'm cold. The moonlight's cold."
"Lie down."
A great shiver went through his body as she took him in her arms.
"I am afraid, Takver," he whispered. "Brother, dear soul, hush."
They slept in each other's arms that night, many nights.